And I've asked Danielle to speak tonight, and she's someone who's earned a lot of love and a lot of respect, not only in our fellowship, but in the outside community. Danielle, she's celebrating 7 years tonight also. Thank you. Thank you very much. God, I feel so good to be here now. You know, I was really kind of scared, you know, because I can talk in front of 200 people, but when it's your peers, it's a little different. You know, you got to watch out for all those lies you told, you know. So I parked my little car out there, and this little short drunk with his hat flipped up, he walked up to me, and he says, I need a cup of coffee. You know, and his breath smelled like alcohol, and I said, honey, you need a drink. You know, and so I gave him some money to go get a drink. Because I can remember one time in the last stages of my addiction, when by then it was Thunderbird, that I needed a drink real bad, you know, and I walked up to this lady, and I was scared to ask for money for a drink. I don't know why, something about me, you know, I'd rob you, but I didn't want to ask you for no goddamn money. And I walked up, and this lady could just see, you know, that what I was in, and she handed me a $5 bill, you know, no conversation, no nothing. And that was the best day of my life, because I didn't need no conversation. I needed a drink, you know, and that's where my addiction ended up for me, but that's not where it began for me, you know. Nobody starts out, I guess, you know, saying, gee, when I grow up, I want to be a dope fiend and get all kinds of fucked up trouble and try to kill myself and have everybody hate me, you know, and, you know, I don't know what happens along the way. Well, I do know what happens, but you know, I don't think I started out that way either. I was just kind of a little girl, and I remember in the Dalles, Oregon, where I was born, I was just kind of a little girl that was lonely a lot. I was an only child, and I guess the first happy years I remember, my mother had married this man, John Hendrickson, and I was real happy with him. I thought he was my dad, and he turned out not to be my real father, but I thought he was my father, you know, and I was real happy and content with that. And then she got divorced. She tended to get divorced a lot, you know. She didn't do marriage very well, and we moved around a lot. And for years, I didn't understand what dysfunctional families were. I didn't understand why she just didn't marry one guy, and, you know, we live in a nice little house and happily ever after. But I understood after I got clean and sober for a while. My mother was an orphan, and when she was 9 years old, her mother died, and she was kind of left alone, and her father left her at a bus stop, and she stayed there for 2 days. And then they picked her up, and they took her to an orphanage where she stayed until she was 18 years old. So she didn't have a lot of experience with functional behavior herself. But, you know, and that dysfunction carries on, and it was that way with me, too. And we moved around so much. I was always the new kid on the block. And, you know, I kind of had the dope fiend kind of brain real young. I remember the first time I was ever really kind of sleazy, there was a dollar bill left on the dresser of our house, and I took the dollar bill, and they asked me if I took it, and I said, no, I swear to God I didn't take it, you know, and I remember my mom saying, well, she swore to God, so I suppose she didn't take it. Boy, I use that term a lot, you know, I swear to God. And anyway, you know, We ended up in West Oakland, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with West Oakland, but there ain't too many white folks there. And there I was, and I kind of felt like always a misfit anyway. I'm Jewish, I got a Mexican dad, and came up in an all-black neighborhood. And I never did know what color I wanted to be, you know. And that was hard when I got clean and sober, too. You know how they tell you, just be yourself, and you go, which fucking one? You know? For me, you know, I was a dope fiend that didn't, you know, that didn't find the dope till she was 14. But boy, when I found dope, it was like instant love. You know, I'm that kind of dope fiend that the first day I laid my lips on something, I was gone. You know, and my first time I ever did drugs, I broke my leg, and they gave me Secanol Reds. You know, and boy, I thought that was good shit, you know, and they tell you take one every so hours. Well, if one is good, two is better, and if two is good, four is gooder, you know, and before I knew it, I was dropping about 20 reds on a daily basis, and my leg had healed, you know, and I'd zip up to the pharmacy. Dope fiends weren't all over the place to fuck it up for everybody, you know, you could go up there and take your script and give them your little money and get on down the ramp, you know. And so I did that about a year, and the pharmacist says, "Hey, Danielle, I think you got a drug problem." And I thought, no shit, you know. You know, I was drinking a little Robitussin and all that good stuff, too. You know, all you had to do then is sign, and it was all right, you know, so I started going on the corners. I liked, you know, I thought, well, where's the dope, you know, and in Oakland, the dope was around. So I'd go up to the corners, you know, and you had to learn the little lingo, you know, and that got easy for me, and I liked that. And we smoked weed, and I liked wires. And in those days, wires were easy to get. You know, they had, amphetamines weren't dope. In those days, you know, amphetamines were okay. If you took amphetamines, or even if you shot crank, you weren't a dope fiend. You know, you were only a dope fiend if you were an opiate user. You know, and so I thought, hey, I like this. You know, they had fat clinics all over, you know, and you could roll up. I'd roll up weighing 90 pounds and say, I need some diet pills, you know. And so that didn't go over too well, but, you know, I tried. I remember I went to one time, and they gave me a bunch of vitamins, you know, and I thought, fuck you people, and I went out and sold them, you know, as amphetamines, and told them I got them from the fat clinic, I was never a success at anything. I'm such a good 50-yard dasher, I'd start everything. Like, I'd always start new schools, and I'd get A's the first, you know, 3 months I was there, and I mean, that was trying to make me look good, and then I would never go to school no more, you know. And that was with everything, and then I just quit going to school. I remember I went to enroll in this one school, and the principal was this lady who was real tall and real proper looking, and she told me I was an undesirable character. And I bought that. You know, I bought that I was an undesirable character. And so if I was going to be an undesirable character, I was going to do the best job of it I could ever do. And I proceeded to do that. You know, I was kind of watching all my girlfriends go along and graduate from high school and, you know, go to college and kind of be cutesy and shit. And I'm standing on the corner smoking weed talking shit. You know, that was about all I was, you know, And I was into a lot of wires and downers, but not too much else then, you know. And I'd always see the guys like Tony and, you know, hanging on the corner with the tattoos, and I'd think, that was those people. I'll never be like that. I can remember thinking that because I was just eating pills and stuff. And I didn't like to drink much because I drank once when I was 14 and ended up in jail. I had a blackout, and from what they told me is I crawled up the side of a cop's car. So I decided alcohol probably wasn't a very good drug for me. And I ended up in juvenile hall, and so, you know, I kind of liked just drugs. I thought they were more healthy. And So I was using it, and I realized something told me that, you know, I wasn't doing a very good job of life and that I better try to turn myself around. But I can remember feeling and thinking that amphetamines were good for me. They made me energetic. They made me smart. They made me be able to talk to people. And I needed that. I remember believing that with all my heart. I remember talking about amphetamines like, this is my dose of medicine. That I was self-medicating me. When I took amphetamines, I was more effective. You know, and I believed that with all my heart at the time. And that's mainly, too, because I was under the influence of amphetamines all the time, too. But, you know, I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll get married, and I'll marry some square dude, and we'll move to a cul-de-sac, and I'll join PTA and have babies, you know, and all that good shit. And so I found this little old dude, and I got married, and I stayed married a whole hot 28 days. He didn't fix me, you know. And so when I left him, I mostly married him because he was in the Air Force, and I knew there was an allotment from, you know, to the Air Force. And sure enough, I got an allotment, but I found out I was pregnant. And I was a baby having a baby. You know, for some reason, I didn't use drugs at that time, and I don't know why, but I'm real grateful because my daughter, Tiffany, was born okay. But I wasn't okay after I had her because I didn't know anything about being a mom, and I didn't know anything about anything, to tell you the truth. And I asked my mom if she'd take care of Tiffany at the time, and she said she would. And, you know, it's like with a lot of the decisions I made in life, they seem like small decisions at the time, but they're enormous decisions because it took me years and years and years to make amends for that decision to let my mother take care of my daughter. And so I went back to doing what I'd always done, and that's getting loaded and hanging on the corner again. Now, you know, now I was seeing all my friends be productive citizens, and I sure wasn't a productive citizen. I was getting into drugs more and more, and my tolerance had built so, you know, I could drop 100 wires on a daily basis and 20 reds. You know, and I was a righteous space cadet, you know, and I'd start a million things. You know how you do on wires? You start cleaning out the fucking drawer, and you start writing over here, and then, you know, you go back and nothing's done, and, you know, and I'd paint the house, and, you know, one time I wallpapered the toilet seat, and my husband sat on it. You know, I was just squeaky, and I just thought I was really charming. I really did. You know, we think we're okay when we get to this program, you know, and, you know, I couldn't believe it, and so I thought, God, my life is really going nowhere, you know, and I could see that because I could never follow through on anything. You know, I was okay when I was wired, but I just couldn't follow through. I couldn't stay wired all the time, you know. I tried, but I couldn't, and, so I remember I thought, well, I'll square up again. You know, my desire in life was to be a square who used drugs successfully. I was really into reality, you know. And so I thought, well, I'll square up this time. And what I did was I got married again. I got a job, and I got a civil service job. I thought, that's just kind of the epitome of respectability, you know, and I took a civil service job. But at that time, I lived with this knowledge of myself, you know, that I'm no good. I'm no good. And every phase of that civil service test I went through, I just knew they'd bump me. I knew they'd never let me do it. And I remember I went to the oral interview, you know, it was about 3 steps into the civil service thing. And I went to this oral interview, and I couldn't believe they were actually listening to me and talking to me like I was a person. And I started crying, you know, and they hired me anyway, you know. And I thought, this is the happiest day of my life. I'm a citizen, you know, except there was one thing wrong. nothing filled that void, you know, and I still had that desire to use drugs. And I got married again, and I married a real nice man. He was kind of a hip square, you know, but, you know, when I really get honest, too, which has been real hard for me to do when I talk about the husband I had, because I want to make him look good all the time. He was very violent. You know, I always married violent men. I loved violent men. The bigger and uglier and meaner they were, the better, you know. And I never talk about that. It's like, I don't want you to think that I ever got beat up. You know, I mean, because I hate broads that let themselves get beat up. You know, and I never want to talk about that. But I made up my mind tonight to be real, real. And that's real important to me. But my husband was violent, you know, and he said the reason he was violent because of my behavior. And I believe that, too. Because I know a lot of us addict women get beat up. And a lot of us believe we have it coming. And I certainly did, and to this day I can still kind of think that some of the things I did to him probably would make you want to beat me up, you know. Like when I stabbed him in the shoulder blade, I imagine that would want to make you beat somebody up. You know, and I ran over him with his car. And, you know, so I am not saying some of those things he said weren't legit, but... At any rate, you know, I had another daughter, and my daughter was Renee, and you know, my daughter Tiffany, I never had that chance to bond with her, but when I met Renee, you know, I remember thinking, dear God, thank you for this precious little baby. She was just everything to me. And I took her home, and I was so grateful to have this little baby. You know, and I thought, and I told her when she was born, baby, I'll always try to do the best for you. But my best was still filled with drugs. You know, and I was this meter maid and had a fair home and you know, was doing kind of okay. But what I found myself doing was sneaking down to the corner and scoring. You know, first I'm just going to buy a bag of bennies. And then, well, I always smoked weed. I didn't think weed was a drug. It was an herb, you know. I thought everybody got up in the morning and smoked a joint for breakfast. I just thought it was a thing to do. And, you know, I'd find myself, well, I need some more energy to write tickets, you know. And I thought, well, if I take guineas, I'll be a better meter maid, you know. And I can write more tickets. I was a speedy meter maid, I will say that. I used to write about 200 tickets a day, but I would get kind of fucked up because I remember one time I've got my little meter maid scooter and I'm going down and I'm saying, God damn, all these people are parked the wrong way on a one-way street, and this cop rolls up beside me and says, Danielle, you know you're going the wrong way down a one-way street? So I guess I wasn't as efficient at my job as I thought I was, you know. But I started really getting tweaky then, you know, because I had access to a lot more drugs, you know, and I was using a lot more. At that time, the pill trade was kind of going down, you know. That was kind of the end of the era of the Reds and the Bennies and stuff, and everybody was in a panic. You know how you do, you go in a panic when your drugs aren't here, and so my choice was at the time to stop using or to start using crank. You know, I had discovered that crank was just like Benny's, except gooder, you know. And then I found out that the way you do crank, you can eat it or you can fix it. And so what I remember saying to myself, I'll just eat it, you know, because then I still won't be a dope fiend. So I'd, you know, eat it all the time, and I couldn't stand to snort nothing. I could never stand to snort no dope. You know, I don't see how you guys stick all that shit up your nose. I still don't understand that. If I can't cook it, I don't want it, you know. So anyway, I started using a lot of crank, and that got real desperate real quick, and then I began to fix drugs. The first time I fixed drugs, it was just like the first time I used drugs. It was instant love. I went down to this girl's house, and she was a heroin addict, you know, and I went down there. I kind of was fully intending to learn how to fix dope. And I went down there, and she had a cotton of some hair on, and she said, "Do you want to fix this?" And I said, "I do." And so she cooked it up, put it in, you know, in the syringe, and I said, "No, I don't want to." And then she chased me around the bathroom for a while. She said, "Well, fuck you, I'll fix it." You know, and I said, no, let me. And I fixed, and I was back the next day. I wanted to learn myself. You know, that's how quick I got addicted to shooting dope. And I was shooting crank like a mad woman, and my husband was really getting upset. At this time, I weighed about 68 pounds, and the biggest thing about me was my head. You know, and that was the years of the wigs, and I used to wear this wig, and when I'd get fucked up, so would it. You know, it was all 8 deuces on my head. So, you know, I kind of got scared, and then I started messing around with some people. Coke was just coming into the scene, but Coke was real high priced. And white folks had Coke, you know, and they wanted to deal a little bit in my neighborhood. And so they didn't want to mess, you know, they didn't want to do all the personal stuff. And so I was kind of a middle person. I'd introduce so-and-so to so-and-so. And, you know, I would really, I'm a nickel-dime dope fiend. I mean, I don't have, you know, I didn't have any grandiose big bag money here. No way. But I got involved with people with the big bag, you know, just this little introduction thing. And so I got busted, you know, and when I got busted, I looked like this big cocaine dealer. You know, here I am finding, you know, quarter bags to shoot and stuff, you know, and I'm busted with this $250,000 worth of fucking coke, you know, and needless to say, the Oakland Police Department didn't want me to be their meter maid anymore. And they kind of, you know, frowned on me. They were sorry they ever knew me, you know, and so I started going to jail. You know, I really believed in my tweaky brain that I was above going to jail. I guess I thought because I worked for the Oakland Police Department, I wasn't going to get popped. You know, and that nobody knew that I was using drugs. You know, and I had this little uniform on that was a size 1 or whatever it was, and it used to fall off all the time, and I'd go in my eyes bug, and I'd be like this, and thought nobody knew I was using drugs. And so I started going to jail at that time, and I went to jail, and that was my kind of first time there, and I did a little time, and my husband took care of my daughter, and he was real embarrassed about me, and you know, it's funny, my mother, I asked my mother, "What do you remember most about my drug addiction, Mama?" And she says, "Well, I remember your name being on the front page, and that you weighed about 68 pounds, and you were sick, and you had hepatitis, and you were on your way to jail." You know, and that's the reality of how addiction was for me. You know, sad, sorry, pitiful, couldn't get out of bed. You know, and I thought I was big shit going to jail because I had the $250,000 worth of coke. You know how you think you're hot shit when you go to jail and ain't about nothing. And I remember coming out then, and nobody thought I was hot shit anymore. Just everybody thought I was a real lame. And I didn't stop using drugs, you know, and I embarrassed my daughter because we had to move because she couldn't go to school where we were because all the kids knew her mother had been in jail for a drug bust. You know, and I went to jail several times after that. I started, you know, petty theft, a lot of petty theft stuff I did, a lot of little nickel dime stuff. I became an all-out street person. And so, you know, finally judges get sick of your butt, you know, and I remember this one judge telling me, "Danielle, you know, if you don't straighten up your hand, I'm going to send you to prison for 5 to life. Well, I got real scared because I'd only been in Santa Rita, which is county jail, you know, but I'd never been to prison, and I didn't want to go to prison, and I made, another wonderful decision this time in my life. I was so good with decisions. I don't know how I ever did this. I told everybody in my family, I'll stop using drugs, you guys, and I'll start drinking. You know, and I thought they'd all be thrilled. And nobody was, you know, but I remember feeling that that was a step up. Because I wasn't an alcoholic. I was just a dope fiend, you know, and I really didn't think that I could be addicted to alcohol because I didn't like it. I thought that about heroin and other drugs, too. Even Elavil, I thought that, you know. But I could be addicted to any drug. It doesn't matter what it is. So I started drinking, and drinking altered my behavior radically. You know, I'm 5 feet tall, and I weigh 100 pounds, but when I'm drunk, I think I'm 6 feet tall, and I like to fight. And I got in fights all the time. You know, I'd just go up to somebody and say, fuck you, bitch, you know, and people don't take kindly to that, you know. And I fought with my husband, and you know, he could kind of stand me on drugs, but on alcohol, you know, we'd start to go to bed, and he'd say, I don't want to go to bed with Thunderbird one more night, Danielle, you know. And I became really radical on alcohol. And so I did the thing that most druggies do, you know, I began to blame everybody. You know, if I didn't live in Oakland, if I didn't have a mother like I did, this and that, I'd be okay. And so I took Renee and I went to the state of Washington. And I thought I'd be better there, because you know how you make those geographicals, and I thought, oh, I'm going to be better in Washington. So I went up there, I bought a car that day for $100, and I didn't hardly have any money, and we went to Washington. And we landed, and I got a little trailer house, and we cleaned it all up. The first night I was there, I was just going to drink a few beers, you know, and we were there, and we were cleaning up with Pine Sol. Renee and I always cleaned up everything. That made me a better class of drunk than the rest of everybody, you know, because I was tidy, wino. And we were cleaning up, and I saw this rat, you know, and I thought, you know, is this for real? I really, you know, wasn't sure. And Renee said, Mama, there's a rat there, you know, and so I thought, God, our life has really gone downhill. We're in this little trailer, and, you know, we got a rat living with us, and, you know, and I hadn't lived with any four-legged rats for a while. So, you know, Renee really started to notice my drinking. She was getting older, and we were in this little town in Washington, and, you know, she wanted me to be Mama, and she'd ask me, Mama, I want you to quit drinking. And I'd say, well, this is better than using drugs. And I'd sit down and I'd tell her this thing like I was doing something so much better. You know, but my drinking had gotten so bad at that time. You know, women can't drink as long as men. And I began to have seizures from alcohol. And sometimes I'd have seizures and I'd wake up to find Renee over me, and she'd say, Mama, what can I do to help? And she'd have big tears in her eyes, you know. And I'd promise and swear by everything that was holy I wasn't going to drink anymore. And I'd mean that. And a day or two would go down the road and I'd need another drink, you know. But this time it was going to be different. I wasn't going to drink Coors. I was going to drink Budweiser, you know. And I wasn't going to drink till 5 o'clock. But the end result was I always got drunk. And I ended up in the hospital quite a few times in Washington, and it was always going to be better, and it was always going to be different, and it never was. And then I got real sick from alcohol. I had cirrhosis of the liver, and the doctor said, you're just going to die, Danielle, from alcohol. And so I accepted that. I thought, well, I'm going to die from alcohol, you know, so what? But I thought I better come back to Oakland. At least we could be with my people so they could help me take care of Renee. So I got back to Oakland, and my desire too at that time was to start using drugs because I functioned better on drugs. And I came back and I got an apartment. I could always kind of hustle an apartment. And I got one where my ex-husband used to live. He helped me, and we got in there, and they gave me a job there cleaning apartments because I couldn't do anything anymore much. You know, I wasn't very functional. And I did get better for a while. You know, like sometimes, you know, it talks about we go through phases where it looks like we're getting better. And it looked like to me we were better. And I had my little welfare check and the money from that I made cleaning apartments. And it was pretty good, you know. I got in some kinds of trouble. Hell, I was on probation forever. They always had me do work hours and volunteer hours and stuff. And that's where I met Tony, in fact. I was cooking at a Mexican recovery center, you know, and my volunteer target, I took a look at Tony and I said, oh my God, that guy's bad news. I like him, you know, because I knew he wasn't about nothing either, you know. And so, you know, and in the meantime, I learned about Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. Narcotics Anonymous was almost impossible to find. You know, even in the Bay Area at that time, you had to go down windy roads in these sleazy little places where all the drapes are drawn, you know. And you weren't a dope fiend unless you shot heroin. You know, if you were a prankster, you weren't a dope fiend. You know, I said, well, fuck you people. I'll go shoot some dope, you know, and learn how. And I did. I went out and shot some heroin, you know, and so I could be a bona fide dope fiend. And anyway, you know, we came back and we were doing all right there, and Renee was getting to be a teenager, you know, and I always wanted things to be real good for her, you know. I used to go clothes shoplifting for her, you know, and always had her wear nice clothes, you know, and the way, you know, I'd rationalize my drug use by saying, well, I can shoplift this, so it's okay if I use this money for this. You know, I mean, a million of them we've got. And so she kind of dressed nice, and Mom had her little hustles, and, you know, I used to like to do credit cards and checks. That was my hustle. But on alcohol, you can't do credit cards because nobody wants to give you, you know, no play on a credit card when you're drunk, you know, and I was getting not good at it anymore. I used to break into mailboxes all over Oakland. I'd get tweaked and break in and take all the mail and find out if there was a credit card in there, and then I'd go run it for a hot minute and scared to death all the time, you know, but did it anyway. And checks, I did. If I had a stack of checks like that, I thought they were to spend, you know, and I did. And I got busted for forgery, and I did a little time on that one, too. But Renee, she began to join a lot of groups, I noticed, you know. And the group she joined, she joined the drama group and another group. And in one of them, she had to play like she was a drunk. And she played such a good job of it, the teacher called me up and asked me if there was any members of our family that were drunks. And I got highly offended. See, in the family of alcoholics, and addicts, I didn't want our secret to be taken out of the house. And, you know, I told her, don't you ever tell anybody what I am. Don't you ever tell anybody. I didn't know what pain she had to live with keeping that secret. You know, and at that time, I didn't have too many boyfriends over the years. I, you know, had a few. But, you know, I had Tony. When I met Tony, I liked Tony as a boyfriend because he was always in prison. You know, he's the kind of guy that tell you he's going out for a loaf of bread and you wouldn't see his ass for 3 years. And so, you know, he was all right by me, you know. Of course, here we were, two dope fiends, and you know, every time he'd go to jail, I'd get another boyfriend. He'd get out of jail, and he had another girlfriend in San Francisco, and he'd bring her dope over, and we'd shoot it, and we were good, you know, real healthy shit, you know. Both of us old, you know, when an old dope fiend starts to, his hustle gets funky and stuff, and you start drinking alcohol, you know, that's when you're through, you know. But you don't want to cop to that, you know. And we were old dope fiends, drinking more wine than dope, but talking like we, you know, had the bag and shit. and he had all kinds of bottles hid in the cupboard, and he'd tell Renee, don't tell. And I'd tell Renee, you know, I'd go score some crank and do this, and I'd say, tell Renee, don't tell. My goodness, what that child had to live with, you know, the secrets in a sick family. And, at that time I could feel impending doom. I was getting ready to get kicked out of my apartment anyway because of some of my antics and Tony's around the place. You know, we weren't good neighbors. I kind of laughed. Here I lived in this apartment building where there was whores and pimps and thugs and mugs, and they asked me to leave because I was too rowdy. And so anyway, I could feel impending doom coming. You know, I guess every addict here has felt like impending doom at one time of their life. For me, I'm glad impending doom fucking happened, because it was not as bad as I had thought impending doom was going to be. You know, I was kind of grateful to get it over with, you know. And I sent Renee to my mother, you know, at that time, and she'd always been with me, but I sent her and I said, Nene, you go stay with Grandma, and I'm going to get sober and I'm going to join you. And she looked at me that look like, how many times have you told me that, Mama? You know, and I sent her to Farmersville, where my mother owns a home, with that. And, when she left, all shit hit the fan, and Tony came barreling through the building like he does. Doors have no meaning to Tony when he's drunk, you know. And he'd go through them, and I had a little 25 that I carried in my apron at all times, you know, that used to backfire, and it was a good gun, you know, and I shot at him, and, you know, the dog was barking, and the police come, and he cut all the wires to the telephones and all the buildings. It was real good stuff. That's when they asked me to leave and never return, you know, and I didn't have nowhere to go. By this time, my drinking had gotten so out of hand that I was not anybody wanted to be around. You know, I'd go down to a place called the California Hotel, you know, on San Pablo Avenue, and I'd go down there and drink with the drunks down there, and even they didn't like me. You know, because dope fiends don't drink like winos. You know, winos share shit and they're real nice and stuff. And a dope fiend just slides up on you, wants to hit it, you know, and leave. And I'm not sharing anything, you know, when I'm drinking or using. And so I didn't have any friends left. And Tony did one of his usual numbers. He went back to jail. You know, it was nearing winter time, and he went back to jail, and here I was holding the bag, and I put what little stuff I had left in storage, and I didn't have no place to go and no friends, and I wasn't going to call my mom at that time because I was in real bad shape. And I remember taking a Safeway shopping cart from Safeway down on 29th and Broadway. And I had put my little clothes in the shopping cart and my little jug of Thunder Chicken, which I was drinking at the time. And, heading down to what we call Old Man's Park. And Old Man's Park is a place in right down in town in West Oakland. And it's where all the used-to-bes are, you know. People that used to have the bag, that used to do something, and they're all down there drinking, and you can buy anything down there, you know, outfits, drugs, a piece of ass, anything you want is down there. I don't know if anybody wants a piece of ass from down there, but you can buy it. And, I'd go down there, and the old men's play dominoes, and I'd sit down there, and I'd play dominoes with those men, you know, and I'd wonder, how did I get here? I just, you know, I couldn't figure how. I didn't know about progression. I didn't know about this, you know, but I knew that I was there and I was drinking. And, you know, I guess that's when I began to surrender. I guess that was the process of surrendering. All those things had to happen to make a total surrender, you know. And you know, just because I made a total surrender, though, doesn't mean I quit using at that time. because it takes more than surrender, and it takes more than one step to stay clean and sober, which I certainly know by now. But I did surrender. I can remember, you know, they talk about those moments of clarity. And I believe with all my heart that was when God came into my life and said, okay, little girl, you're too lame to know. But I did know that I had to surrender. And I thought, how am I going to get sober now? By this time, for those of you who haven't drank enough yet, I'll enlighten you on the wonderful disease of alcoholism. When you drink enough and you just saturate your body and you turn into a wino, you know, which I was at this time, when I began to withdraw from the drug of alcohol, I began to have seizures. And I was so scared of withdrawing from the drug of alcohol because I just really thought I was going to die, that I didn't know how to do that. It was really, really fearful. And I called up this girl and I said, can I stay at her house? Her son was at summer camp, you know. And I said, I need to kick this alcohol. And she said, I remember she told me at that time, she gave me her little 10-cent lecture, you know, that they can do because you have to suck ass because you have no place else to go. And she said, Danielle, you've got to learn to be responsible for your own self. And I thought, fuck you. But I had to do that, and she was dead bang right. And I went to her house, you know, and in my lifetime I've kicked a lot of drugs. A lot of drugs. But I never wanted to kick one like wine ever again. That Thunderbird, you know, you drink enough of that and it makes your lip purple and your ass flat, you know, and then you try to kick it and it's tough business. And I saw rats on the wall that weren't there, and I finally got off that drug of alcohol, and it was real hard. And so she kind of cleaned me up after a few days, and she said, why don't you go to a meeting? And I got on the bus, and I was real disoriented, and I got on the bus, and I rode to the meeting, and I went to the meeting, and I started going to meetings. And sometimes I had this little disability bus pass, you know, that you get on the bus for a quarter. You could go all over for a quarter and get transfers. And I'd get on the bus and just ride around. And in Oakland, if you get in the back of the bus, you can smoke weed, you know. And so I had to go on the back of the bus because I thought that's where I belonged. And I went back there and I started smoking a little weed, but I was going to the meetings, you know, and I finally did get some sobriety. And after I had about a month clean, I called my mom and I said, Mom, I'm sober, you know, and I told Renee, can you guys come and get me? And Nene knew I was clean because she could tell in my voice, you know. And she came to get me, her and my mom, and they said I was still a pretty sick cookie, though, because I tried to put my shopping cart in my mom's car. And apartment in Tulare. I got back on welfare again, and we got an apartment in Tulare, and she went to school at Tulare Union. And, you know, by this time, Nene was 14 years old, and I watched her, you know, become the soloist in the choir and get A's and B's. And I thought, you know, I know now what this disease addiction does to our homes and what we do to our children. See, Renee was the superhero. Renee always wanted to look good. If you knocked on the door and I was in there passed out, and Nene would say, everything's fine, don't worry about it. You know, she always tried to make everything look good. And I realize now that's the role she played, but I didn't know about those things, but I did know that it was getting better. I took my third step with my daughter, Renee. You know, I made amends to Renee, which I'm real grateful for. And we went to meetings all the time because I thought she had to be there on the downside. She can be on the upside and learn. And we used to read the book together, you know, all the time. And I got real grateful, you know, for this program because I began to see better things happen for us. You know, we ate every day. Things were okay. And as I grew in this program, you know, I began to work the steps. I got a sponsor. You guys told me here, get a female sponsor. I got a male. You guys told me don't get involved in relationships. I did. You know, I did what I wasn't supposed to do, but I didn't drink and use. You know, I was still real oppositional. I was glad for the, I finally got a lady sponsor like I, it was suggested I do. And she was the kind of sponsor that says, get your own butt to meetings, Danielle. You know, and I liked that because I was never the kind of person that could have a sponsor that would tell me anything because I knew I'd do just the opposite. I was new in recovery and I just couldn't stand anybody telling me anything yet, you know. Even if they were right, I didn't want to hear it. I didn't care. You know, but I just didn't drink and use. That I learned. For some reason that I learned. I guess the surrender process had taken effect. I knew I was powerless. I knew the first step when I rolled up here. I knew the first step. You know, and I wanted to go to a lot of meetings, and I did. At first, we didn't have the NA then, and I had to go to AA, and they used to have a little directory, and I'd call different people, and nobody knew me, you know, and I'd call different people to take me to meetings. I remember one time I called Don W., and I didn't know who he was, and he didn't know who I was. And I said, look, I need to go to a meeting. Will you pick me up? And he said, yeah, I'll pick you up. But he had to stop at the rest home to see his father. Well, in the meanwhile, I had decided to get real honest, and I started telling him a bunch of shit about what I'd done in Oakland, and he was scared to leave me in the car alone. So, you know, I couldn't figure out why he invited me into the rest home, you know, and later on, you know, we became real good friends, and we've been friends ever since, but he said he was scared to death to leave me in his car. And, so anyway, you know, I Renee and I'd go to meetings and everything got real good, and I thought, boy, this is the answer to our prayers. And I saw life was so different. You know, it just kind of gets exciting when you're new here and good things start to happen. You go, you know, golly, this happened, or I got a job, or I got a driver's license, or, you know, it's just like we're little kids and stuff, you know, and it's exciting stuff. And it's neat to see, and I was like that, and Renee was like that, and I could take her to the stores, and I didn't have to go shoplifting anymore and, you know, buy her things. I remember the first Christmas, she was sober, and I was sober and clean, and I went to the most expensive store, and I bought her a purple sweater and purple pants, and she was the most beautiful girl at school, you know, and it took a whole, all of my check, you know, and I said, you know, this is what I want to do. And she went to school so proud, and everything was really okay. And it was almost one year that I was going to celebrate in the program. And I think I'd gone to about 700 meetings, and I became involved. You know, I volunteered at Pine Recovery Center, and Renee wanted to go see her dad in Oakland, because she was coming up on 15 years old and she wanted to spend some time with him. And I said that would be okay. And she was a little worried to leave me alone, you know, because she wasn't sure I'd be okay. And I said, you go ahead, honey. Mama's okay. And I wanted her to have a good time. So she'd call me every day. And when she called me, she'd always say, you okay, Mama? Did you go to your meeting? One day she called me. And I still remember sitting over there at Pine and answering the phone, good afternoon, Pine Recovery, this is Danielle. And she laughed and she said, oh, Mommy, you sound so good, you know, like a grown-up. You know, because I used to answer the phone when I had a phone, what? You know. So she told me, she says, Mom, I'm having a good time, I'll be home soon. And she said, for some reason, if something happens to me, Mama, do you promise you don't drink? And I said, sure, baby. And I hung up the phone, and I went about my business that day, and I went to a meeting that night, and I felt uncomfortable. I didn't know why. And I went to bed that night, and the phone rang real early in the morning. I don't know what time. And my mother-in-law was on the phone, and she said, Renee had been out with her friends, and a drunk driver came up behind the car, and my daughter's neck was broken, and she was dead. And she was 15 years old. She was born August 1st, and she died August 27th. And I said, no, and I hung up the phone. I didn't believe it. And they called me back on the telephone, and I remembered the steps that I was taught in this program. It says, make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. And all I could think of is, you got it, God, I can't hang. And I hung up the phone, and I called somebody, I don't even remember who, I think Maria. And before I knew it, I had a bunch of people at my house, you know, to help me. And I was like in shock, like when you come down off a crank and you're in that tunnel. I felt numb, and I've learned that that's a protection, I guess, that God gives you so you don't have to feel, because I didn't know what to feel. I couldn't believe it. I was in disbelief, denial, too. And I went to Oakland, and I buried my daughter, and I didn't know what to do with myself. And at that time, Tony had still been in jail, and he was about to be released, and I called over to the prison, and I told him to tell him that Renee had died. And I didn't really ever think I'd see Tony again, because I never thought Tony would get clean, to tell you the truth. I never thought I'd get clean, but I never thought he would more. And so, you know, I came back to Visalia, and I kept wanting to run. I just kept wanting to run. I isolated, and all I could think of was that saying that they say in Alcoholics Anonymous that says, be sure your relationship is right with Him, and great things will come to pass. And my loneliness at that time, I missed Renee so bad. You know, everywhere I turned, every time I woke up, every breath I took, well, Renee is not here. Renee is missing. Where's Renee? And you know, and I kept praying, and I kept praying, and I kept praying. And I used that loneliness time to get to make sure that that relationship was right with Him. You know, I didn't do what I was supposed to do. They told me don't isolate and don't do these things. But for me, that was an important part of my recovery, because I just needed to get close with God. That's all I needed to do at that time. Because I really didn't want to be around a lot of people. Sometimes people said things to me that were, I felt, were really inappropriate. Like some people in the program would tell me, oh, it's God's will. You know, or some people would tell me that this is for a reason, or, you know, all kinds of things I couldn't understand why they said to me, and I really didn't want to hear them. So what I did was, just isolate. I went to a lot of meetings, though. And when I'd go to meetings, I'd put my head on the table, and I didn't want to talk to anybody. And I'd just go to meetings. And I began to learn what step two was all about. See, I came in on step one. I knew what that was about. Step two, I'd kind of skipped over. You know, because I thought the insanity was just when you were using. But when my insanity really started to unfold is after Renee died, and I was clean. And all I could remember was her words, don't drink, don't use, don't drink, don't use. And you had told me that here, but I remember her saying it, and that, I think that kept me clean and sober. But talk about insanity. If you're new to this program and you're 30 or 60 days clean and sober and you think everything's going to be wonderful and glorious, well, guess what? You know, you will know step two. And when Renee died, I just kind of went beside myself. And then I was real depressed. And I thought, well, I got to get into action. And so I got a job. And at that time, Tony got out of the pen. And I thought, well, that'll be good for me. I'll keep my mind occupied with Tony. Only one problem. Tony was using. You know, and he got out of the pen, and he came to my house and decided to use. And once again, I found myself shooting guns, this time a 38, and police again. And I was stone clean, you know, and going to jail for attempted murder, sitting there, you know. And they said, well, where's the victim? And I said, I don't know where that is, you know. They said, is he hurt? And I said, well, I don't know. I know he didn't take it personally, you know. But I'd made up my mind, you know. One thing I know about us women, that we go back to drugs quicker than guys because we put a relationship above recovery. And I learned that, you know, and I made up my mind this time, you know, recovery had to be number one. Recovery just had to be number one. And when he started to come through that front door again, I thought, no fucking way, you know. And but I suppose there are other methods to take care of that. I have learned there are police and shit, you know. I didn't know how to do that then. But I got real crazy, and I remember that was the day before I was supposed to start my job at National Council on Alcoholism, and I had to call Claude Rutherford, and I said, Mr. Rutherford, I just shot somebody. Do you still want me to go to work for you? And he said, I don't know. You know. So I started going to work, you know, and I started working with kids, and that was really a blessing, because what I learned was that the kids gave me a lot of strength, and the kids made me get honest. You know, if you're honest, you can't be a dope fiend anymore. I mean, it's just impossible to be honest and to be a dope fiend. And, you know, I started to have to get honest. I was talking to all these kids all the time, and they don't know over the years how they helped me. You know, I worked with old Dan over there, you know, and I'd go do 7 classes a day. I don't know how the hell I did that. But I still kept being crazy. You know, I was becoming functional, and I looked like I was functional, and I was working the steps, I thought, and I was doing okay, but I was crazy. You know, and I got thinner, and I was clean and sober, and I got real thin. And I remember I was going to a counselor, and he said, Danielle, I think you better go to Tulare View. And I didn't even know that. There I was, clean and sober, almost 2 years at this time, and I was crazier than shit. You know, so I began to understand what step two was. Step two is my very favorite step. Came to believe in a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I love that step. Because I have learned in this program the depths of my insanity are not when I'm drinking and using, but this insane little person that I've got to live with clean and sober. I don't have anything to anesthetize myself with anymore. And so I have to depend on a higher power, because I don't have the capacity to make me sane. I wasn't starting out with a full deck, you know. So I went to Tulare View at that time, and I remember that's when I started getting well. That's how crazy I am. I was in Tulare View, you know, and I didn't want to take any medication. I said, no, I'm not taking stuff. And I was in there with a woman. My roommate was a woman that thought everybody had syphilis. You know, and all the staff that go by, she'd go, look at him, he's got it, don't let him touch you, you know. And I thought, oh boy, you know. And if you've ever been in a mental hospital, I've been to tons of them when I was loaded, and it was fun, because you get to kick with Valium and shit, you know. But this time I was clean and sober, and I'm sitting in Tulare View, and we have these little groups in the morning, you know. And how good your rap is depends on how soon you get out. And, you know, if you say, you go around and you say, well, I got dressed today and I went to crafts and all that shit, you know. And so I was in group, and I thought, and so I said in group, fuck your groups and fuck your crafts, and I'm not getting dressed. And all the patients cheered, you know. And they told me with an attitude like that, Mrs. Carson, you'll never get out of here, you know. So... but good things did happen to me there. I learned to grieve. You know, and what I learned about grieving is it's the same process we use in addiction. And grieving is the process of denial, anger, bargaining, blaming, and finally that wonderful word, acceptance. Acceptance. You know, and I learned I had to do that with drugs. I had to learn to do that with Renee. I had to learn to do that with everything I've had to cut loose I didn't want to cut loose. The only difference between me now and 7 years ago is I get to acceptance a little quicker. You know, I still go through the whole phase, though. And because I get to acceptance doesn't mean I don't jump back into anger or blaming. Because I do. But it's a process by which I have to go through. You know, I have to do that with Renee still. I mean, she's been dead for 6 years now, and it's still hard, and I still jump back into anger or sorrow, a lot of sorrow still. I miss her very much. But after I got out of Tulare View, what I realized is I can carry on her name with some dignity. That became very, very important to me, that Mama, you know, carry her name on with dignity. And I began to have a dream. But after that, you know, Tony was still gone, you know, after I shot him. And I remember that night, too, because I remember there were a bunch of people from Alcoholics Anonymous over at my house that night, and they were all pissed off at me. And, you know, I couldn't figure out why. You know, but there was about 20 police outside the door that night with, you know, shotguns. Mrs. Carson, put down your gun. You know, and all my friends were lined up against the wall, and they'd never done that. You know, I'd done that a lot. You know, I thought it was kind of fun. Nobody wanted to be friends with me, you know. One guy had to go over to Pine and have a cup of tea. He almost had a heart attack, and I thought, God, what kind of a dope fiend were you, you know? Anyway, you know, so Tony had gotten clean all by himself. You know how maybe you women were kind of like me. You thought, well, you could save some guy, you know. And you know what? He didn't even need me. He went on to Santa Cruz and didn't drink and use. I don't know if shooting him had anything to do with it. I guess that's not recommended in the 12 steps. But, you know, he called me after 16 months, something like that. And he said, Danielle, I'm clean and sober, you know. And, of course, I didn't believe him because he's been known to lie. And so I said, all right, Tony, I'll meet you in Fresno at the Motel 6, you know. So we went to the Motel 6, and, you know, I thought he was all cute, sober, you know. I was like meeting a new man. I always liked that real good anyway. And we started seeing each other again. And I began to have this dream of having this house, you know, and Tony would say, well, we could have a house. He's the one that likes to say, we could do this and we could do that. And I'd say, quit being grandiose, you asshole, you know. So we got a little apartment, and you know, and then we moved to a different apartment. And one thing about Tony and I do, we always fix everything up, and so we'd always re-carpet everything and paint everything. I'm still a tidy wino, you know, but I'm clean. And we saw this house one day, and Tony said, why don't you stop there and look at that house, you know, and I said, oh, that I could never have that. And I went up there, and I told the lady, how do you do? My name is Danielle Carson, and I'm a dope fiend, and this is what I want to do, and I'm a very honorable lady. Do you trust me? And you know what? She said, yeah. She and her husband said, yeah. And they let me lease option my home until I could buy my home, you know. And I've never been late on a payment, and I've never, you know, done anything. Because dope fiends have bad reputations. And I thought, these people are not going to know dope fiends to be sleaze bags. You know, and they've never known me to be a sleazebag. And they think dope fiends are nice people. We're the first ones they ever knew. You know, it's kind of nice. But we named that house after my daughter, Renee. Her middle name was Karis. And that is the most special thing to me. You know, when I answer the phone, I say, Karis House. Every time I think, Nene, do you hear that? And a man in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, you know what, Danielle? Nene can be your guardian angel. And you can carry her with you all the time. And so I talk to her all the time, and I act like she sees everything, and I know she does. And my daughter Tiffany, you know, after Renee died, she has a problem with drugs and alcohol, too. She doesn't drink and use, but when she does drink and use, it gets real good to her real quick. And I tried to make her come to Narcotics Anonymous. Well, that worked real good. You know, you can't change other people. And she had a hard time forgiving me for the way I neglected her and abandoned her. You know, she thought it was me and Renee and not her. And it's taken me almost 7 years, but now when she calls me on the phone, which is every day, she says, I love you, Mom. And that's the nicest thing in the whole world. It's taken a lot of years to heal. Because she was the lost child of our family. The child that just got, you know, left behind. The child that, and Renee was real outgoing and stuff, and Tiffany is kind of quiet and reserved, but she's, you know, she's now going to college and she's studying to be a probation officer, and she's learning how to take risks, and I'm watching the healing work for her, you know. And this program just, it goes out to all the people we touch, just like our addiction disease does. You know, and I've learned that this is so outreaching, because, you know, when we're in this disease of addiction, we infest a lot of people. How many times did I used to say, I'm only hurting myself? You know, I said that many times, and that's the biggest bunch of bullshit I ever told Danielle. Because everybody I touched got hurt. Anybody who loved me got burnt. And that's not the case today. You know, it's nice today. You know, and I filled the house up with six kids, and I'll tell you the truth, I didn't ever want girls because I tended to compare girls to Renee. You know, and that wouldn't have been a fair deal. And so I filled the house full of little boys and little gangsters and mug and thugs, I call them. And, you know, I love them with all my heart, because when Renee died, it was like this sudden interruption of teenage. It was so abrupt. You know, and I missed coming home and saying, turn down the damn music. You know, and I missed that. It was like all quiet. And now it's all back six times over, you know. But they told me, you know, you have to be careful what you pray for around here. And I got a house full, and I took legal guardianship of one little boy, and they called me the other day and they said they got a 10-year-old little boy that's been in a group home for 2 years, and his mother's a druggie, and would I consider maybe adopting him, you know? And I kind of wanted to do this, so I'm going to go visit him up in the Bay Area and spend a day with him, and if we fall in love, you know, I might adopt him. Hell, I don't know, you know. But my whole life is kids. My whole life, sometimes I don't get along with adults all that well, you know. I'm not the kind of woman that likes to hang, you know, in a circle. I never know what to say with a bunch of other women. I'm still like that. You know, I feel real uncomfortable, and I live too long with too many guys that, you know, I go into the beauty shop, it's like fucking culture shock, you know. They're talking PTA and, you know, doing your hair, and I just heard about the bra they got down, you know, and, you know, it takes me a minute to get re-acclimatized. But my whole life is the kids, and without them, I wouldn't know what to do in the world. And, you know, my relationship with Tony is pretty good now. What we always do when we fight, and which we do fight, we just don't do knives and guns anymore, you know. And violence. We don't do violence anymore, you know. I've been known to throw a couple blows, but he don't hit me back no more. That's the good shit, you know. But, you know, my relationship with Tony, we always try to figure out what there's a solution, because one thing I know about me and Tony, we ain't going nowhere. And I figured out that if you're going to have a good relationship, I had to quit thinking I'm going to go somewhere or I'm going to get rid of him. You know, because I always got married or whatever, you know. And then I never thought of a relationship as forever. It's like, oh, you do that for fucking ever, you know, stay married or, you know. And so my relationship with him, I think of on a permanent basis. But my life is meetings and kids to me, you know, and I never stop going to meetings. You know, one thing I know about dope fiends is we get well real quick. And when you get well, watch out, you're in deep shit. You know, and I come to meetings because I'm not well, and I know it, and I know I need this program forever. And why would I not want to come? I have to take a look at that. You know, why would I not want to come to a place that has virtually saved my life? And I called my mom tonight and she said, you know, you were just such a sick person. And she said, and now I'm so proud of you, Danny. You know, and nobody's ever been proud of me in my whole life. And my daughter, she told me, Mama, I'm so proud of you. You know, and those are the kind of things that I live for and long for in this program, to have some peace of mind. And my grandbabies have never seen their granny loaded, never seen me drunk, never seen me be anything but grandma like I'm supposed to be. You know, and I want to thank everybody here for this wonderful time. You know, 5 years ago was when NA started here. And before that we had AA, and a lot of dope fiends didn't make it because you couldn't relate here. And I know that was hard for me. But thank God we've got this now, Narcotics Anonymous. You know, now if you can't relate, shame on your ass. You know, there's something wrong with you. Because we have a place where dysfunctional, sick people, you know, the bottom of the barrel, come here, and we get to be whole people. How many places in life do you get a second chance like we have? And for that, I'm eternally grateful, and I'm so grateful you asked me to speak tonight. That's quite an honor. Thank you, my people.